Ukraine's president says the Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power in his country. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. And Iran beats Wales 2-0 to keep its World Cup campaign alive, prompting celebrations across the country. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. Now our top story, the Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Vladimir Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital, Kiev, and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv, and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure and are intended, that is, to harm civilians, which makes them a war crime. NATO's chief says it's up to Germany to decide if it wants to supply Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems to Ukraine following a request by Poland.
We have also provided significant air defense systems to Ukraine, including with modern systems. Germany has provided modern air defense systems to Ukraine, and I will, at the foreign ministerial meeting next week, urge allies to further step up the support, not least with air defense to Ukraine. But specific decisions on specific capabilities, that remains national decisions.
Jens Stoltenberg was referring to talks between NATO members Germany and Poland over the air defense system. Berlin offered to deploy the U.S.-made system in Poland after a stray missile hit a Polish village near the Ukrainian border last week, leaving two Polish citizens dead. But Warsaw told Germany to ship the system to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. Now, on Thursday, German officials said the Patriot units were intended for use in NATO territory only. Berlin further insists that any use of the weapons outside of this area will need prior discussions with NATO allies. Germany has already cautioned that NATO should not become participant to the Ukraine conflict while trying to strengthen Kiev's defenses. The Turkish president has vowed to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this, which has been repeatedly decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated with the Syrian opposition said that Turkey carried out new raids on northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria about 2 years ago, but it intensified its strikes last week when an explosion in Istanbul left 6 people killed. Ankara has blamed the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based out of Iraq and Syria. They've all denied the allegations. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syrian sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dable says that Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern the northern Syrian areas.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Soaring inflation and worsening cost of living crisis in the UK is triggering more and more industrial action across different sectors. This time, university staff, more than 70,000 of them, are walking off the job in what's been billed as the biggest strike in the history of UK's higher education. Saeed Puraza reports.
150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reasons. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
And now nurses in Britain are also planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase have been turned down by the government. And the strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union will be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales, and Northern Ireland will be walking off the job December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that will help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to their demands.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the Health Secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged a difficult situation the healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of unprecedented inflation. He stressed his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. Planned strikes by the nurses will be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're all struggling to get by as the UK grapples with 40-year high inflation of over 11%. Lembito Peake is a former member of the British Parliament. He tells us the buck stops at Downing Street when it comes to the UK's economic woes.
Pretty much the whole of the public sector is angry with the government right now because it's the government that's messed up. We're picking up the pieces from a government-sponsored recession, a government-sponsored interest rate increase, a government-sponsored inflation rate increase. There's no point in them blaming anybody else. Putin doesn't run the British economy. Putin doesn't make the decisions about where we buy our energy from. So that would be the simple solution. But in practice, the government can't do that because if they do this, then the nurses will get their money, but everybody else will say, well, what about us? And then we head to a general strike. What I conclude from this situation is there is currently no way out for the government except to fix the economy. So they have to do something to bring inflation down and to bring productivity up and also interest rates down. There's one thing they can do there. They can abandon the energy policies they've got. They can start using the gas, which is under the feet of myself and Amin and everybody else in the UK, perhaps even consider increasing oil and even talk about coal. Because at the moment, if they want to insist on having a green environmental agenda, then we're probably going to have a red government after the next general election.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has testified at a public inquiry to defend his use of emergency powers to end the truckers-led protests earlier in the year. Trudeau used wartime measures to clear out protests, which disrupted trade in Ottawa and brought the city to a standstill. The Freedom Convoy, as it was called, was angry at the government-mandated COVID vaccines. Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act after the second week of the street-jamming protests. Police eventually had to tow the big rigs out of Ottawa and arrested some 200 protesters. Trudeau's address wraps up about 6 weeks of hearings at the Public Order Emergency Commission following backlash he received for how he dealt with the protests. And earlier in our news review program, we discussed the protests and the Canadian government's response to them.
Joining us on this edition of the news review, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who is joining us from Belgrade. And we also have Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. First of all, I want to get your overall opinion of how events have transpired. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is now set in a place where he has to testify to a public inquiry about his decision.
Well, unfortunately, the Canadian system is not set up to allow people to hold the political elite to any kind of accountability. When you've got a majority in a parliamentary system like the English or Canadian parliamentary system, you have an effective dictatorship. Until the next election, if you control a majority in the House, you can do literally whatever you want. You can actually suspend the Constitution, which is what what has been done by Trudeau's government, exactly like his own father did in 1970. So in my own case, I've lived through two Trudeau regimes in two cases in which they've both imposed martial law without any threat whatsoever of war. That's what the reality is, unfortunately, in Canada today, and that's exactly what it's been in Canada for more than 50 years.
Well, Robert Fantina is with us from Kitchener, Ontario. Do you agree with what our guest, John Bozich, just said?
Well, I certainly agree in principle that the invocation of this act was an extreme measure. This emergency act is designed for just that, national emergencies, threats to the survival of the government. It sets a dangerous precedent when the prime minister invokes that act in order to quell a protest in Ottawa. Certainly the protest was disruptive to trade, to the businesses, but to take such an extreme measure seems to be really unnecessary. The local police, which of course Trudeau denies this, say that they had a plan, that they were, that everything was under control, and they were going to begin moving the truckers out and ending the disruption, but they were not given the opportunity to do that when Trudeau decided to invoke this act. Again, it sets a dangerous precedent, I think, for him and future Canadian governments.
Iran has defeated Wales 2-0 in the World Cup in Qatar to keep alive its hopes of advancing to the knockout round. Ruzbeh Cheshmi and Ramin Rezaian scored both Iran's goals in injury time to send the fans into ecstasy. Iran now has 3 points in Group B of the games and will face the U.S. in a make-or-break decider on Tuesday. Victory prompted jubilant scenes and celebrations across Iran. In a congratulatory message, President Ebrahim Raisi thanked the national team and vowed to continue to support them. And that's a wrap for your latest. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Experts use the term sabotage for the explosions that occurred at the Nord Stream pipelines and believe that the military and intelligence agencies of various countries or a country must have been behind this complex operation. Meanwhile, Russia has announced that it was the Biden administration that benefited the most from sabotaging Russia's gas pipelines to Europe. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Sputnik news agency has covered this story. The Swedish Security Service stated investigation of the site of the incident at the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines has confirmed sabotage. It was added in a statement in the course of its intensive crime scene investigations carried out on the site of the detonations in the Baltic Sea. The statement said probes showed that the pipelines had been subjected to gross sabotage. The Swedish Security Service probe, headed by a National Security Unit prosecutor, had documented extensive damage to the gas pipelines, Nord Streams 1 and 2, resulting from the blast. It was underscored with a number of seizures made, including foreign items. Sabotage was confirmed after explosion residue was identified in a number of the seized and analysed items. It was underscored that the extensive and complex ongoing probe, coupled with thorough analysis work, would allow for more definitive conclusions about the Nord Stream blasts. The Swedish Security Service stated whether anyone can be suspected of and later prosecuted for the sabotage will rest with the outcome of the investigation. It added a number of agencies, including the Swedish Coast Guard, the Swedish Armed Forces and the Swedish Police Authority, were assisting the investigation. A rapid gas pressure drop and fuel leakage were detected along the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines, the main routes of supply of Russian gas to Europe, on 26 of September this year. Initial investigations by Swedish and Danish authorities had pointed towards likely sabotage. The Russian Prosecutor General's office was prompted to investigate the incident as what the Kremlin called an unprecedented act of state-sponsored terrorism by the West. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Matt Lindqvist, the prosecutor leading the investigation by the Swedish Security Service, said on Friday, 18th of November, analysis that has now been carried out shows traces of explosives on several of the objects that were recovered from the scene of the explosion in the Baltic Sea. Matt Lindqvist said the investigation was very complex and comprehensive, and analysis would continue in order to draw more reliable conclusions and determine whether any suspects could be identified. But the evidence so far was of gross sabotage. Two of the leaks occurred in Denmark's exclusive economic zone, and two in Sweden's. The Swedish daily Expressen reported recently that publishing footage, video footage filmed by an underwater drone, a 50-meter section, was missing from the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Seismologists in both countries recorded tremors in the area just before the leaks were reported that did not resemble those produced by earthquakes, and Denmark said recently that early indications point to powerful explosions. Scientists said the 26th of September ruptures, described by experts as equivalent to several hundred kilograms of TNT exploding, could have caused one of the worst natural gas leaks ever, spewing gas including methane, the biggest cause of climate heating after carbon dioxide into the ocean, that then bubbled to the surface. The pipelines have been at the centre of geopolitical tension after Russia cut back its gas supplies to Europe, apparently in retaliation for sanctions imposed by the West in the wake of Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. London recently dismissed charges by Russia that the British Navy was responsible for the blasts, claiming the allegations were designed to distract from Russian military failures in Ukraine. Washington and Moscow have denied any involvement in the incidents. German authorities are carrying out their own investigation in close cooperation with the Swedish and Danish teams after Berlin's offer of a formal joint investigation was rejected, reportedly over national security concerns. Russia's Russia One television network has also reported the same story. Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service Director Sergei Naryshkin said Moscow has indirect grounds to suggest that the text message saying "it's done" sent by Liz Truss, who was British Prime Minister at the time, to US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken concerned the Nord Stream blasts. Sergei Naryshkin told Pavel Zarubin's Moscow, Kremlin, Putin program on Russia One television, "Well, I only have an indirect proof that all this text message is well grounded." Meanwhile, Sergei Naryshkin noted that Russian citizens should be cautious, whereas the Foreign Intelligence Service should continue preventing external threats. When asked what the Russian side might expect from Western partners, he noted, "We should be cautious, whereas special services, including the Foreign Intelligence Service, should continue revealing and preventing any threats, external threats, against our state and our citizens." Earlier, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said she expected London to provide a response to media reports that Liz Truss sent a message saying "it's done" to Anthony Blinken after the Nord Stream blasts. The Russian General Prosecutor's Office has initiated the opening of a case on an act of international terrorism after the gas pipelines were damaged. After a month-long investigation, the Russian Ministry of Defense revealed recently that Britain's Royal Navy took part in the planning, organization and carrying out of the attack on the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. The damage to the Nord Stream network has robbed Central and Western Europe of a major traditional source of natural gas ahead of winter heating season. Yamal Europe and Soyuz, two major Russian overland pipelines delivering natural gas to Europe, have also been halted or experienced a major drop in their use, sparking questions about the region's energy security.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Back to Reality. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma, your host. Here with, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Brother Abu Zahra.
Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi
wabarakatuh. Wa alaikum assalam. Both of you, welcome to your program. And it's a pleasure to have you in here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Assalamualaikum. It's nice to be here again. I'm a Hausa student right at the moment. I'm in my ninth year. And before this, I was in life sciences. So I've got a taster of quite a few things, alhamdulillah.
Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, and I'm really honored to be here at this episode. My name is Bita, and I'm a medical student.
Today, we're going to talk about a situation which actually happens to all of us, maybe on a daily basis, sometimes more than that, because depending on the people around you, you might face too much of difficulties. And then there are some people who might dagger you with some words that get directly into the core of your heart, break your heart, and then crush you like a grape, and then expect you to forgive them.
Wow.
Actually, myself, personally, I've never gone through this experience, unfortunately.
How come?
You know, I've never, it was
how,
like,
I can't,
okay, I'm so
that
heartbroken or something at all. You know, mm-hmm. It was always easy to go through this because the way I look at people is like, okay, you are a passenger. You are someone who will pass my life and then go your road, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not like you are going to stay forever here in my life, in the story of my life. So
what if they are not passengers?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, a best friend. I mean, your siblings. I mean, your relatives, your close friends.
Even though you're passengers, you know, here I'm the one who will pass their lives, you know. Sometimes you are the one who will pass their other people's lives. And mm-hmm. some other times there are people who will come to your story of life and then they will go out of that.
So you think of yourself as a pearl in a shell. You've been restricted to that shell and nobody there is allowed to get into that.
No, it's not like that. I'm telling you that I don't care that much.
Oh, so this is the point. You don't care.
I'm not ignorant at all. You know, maybe I'm really sensitive to other people's behavior and sometimes mm-hmm. I really get sad or disappointed or something like that from other people's behavior. But... you know, I kind of am getting used to it that, okay, you are human and human is to err and you have some mistakes, you have some defects in your personalities. And I accept all of that and I accept the fact that maybe one day you will break my heart. And despite
so
all
your
these
perspective
facts,
is so nice. I'll come back to you.
Thank you.
Let's have Brother Abu Zahra's idea.
This is the sister who was talking about me being too ideal.
Yeah, exactly. So, has it ever happened to you? Of course it has happened.
Of course it happened.
How is your reaction?
Were you talking about the grip? I don't know if I've been hurt in such a bad way where, you know, maybe I have. And
see,
we
do not understand, but it happens. Sometimes I say something unconsciously without even actually wishing that to happen, but I may say some things that might someone get to their heart.
Definitely. And it's very difficult. I think forgiving is one of the hardest traits that mm-hmm. a person can develop in themselves, to let go easily, right? Sometimes we're even ready to forgive, but that person has to come and ask for forgiveness, you know?
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
We're not ready to let go. It's one of those things that it's hard to let go someone else's mistakes. We're even ready to let go, but they have to come and, you know, mm-hmm. humble themselves in front of us, right? That's how hard it is to let go, that you feel like they need to do something for you to let go. And it's definitely difficult. And that's one of the beautiful traits that Allah prides himself in. He's ghaffar, he's very forgiving. The Prophet was a prophet of mercy.
Exactly.
And it's not a small thing. This is one of the things that makes you wonder about the Prophet. You know, people did so much evil to them, but they were still forgiving. Yeah. And this is how I try to get over it, you know. I always tell myself that, look, if somebody's wronged me, however badly they've wronged me, firstly, they might not have done it intentionally. Secondly, I remind myself that, look, every time I make mistakes, I ask Allah for forgiveness, I expect him to forgive me. Mm-hmm. Then why should I not expect myself to forgive others?
Yeah.
And
now,
in those bitter times when I'm really mm-hmm. annoyed at somebody, this thought calms me down a lot. It really makes me feel like, you know what? It's true. Just let go. If I expect Allah to forgive me, just let go. You know, forgive that person.
Yeah, that is very true. So now that we've just opened up the story, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you to our listeners for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back to IRB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. Here, Sister Bita and Brother Abu Zahra are helping me with the topic, which is a little bit of difficult to practice, that is forgiving. In our religion, we have too much of narrations asking us to be kind. And in the Holy Book of Quran, we have that you would never get into salvation unless you give away whatever you love. And I guess the love of myself is the thing also that I could give away in order to forgive people. And that is going mm-hmm. to be a step toward salvation, which is very difficult because I usually don't like to talk ideal because, you know what, we should come to Earth and talk pretty realistic. I know that
you're not mentioning me, right?
As a human being, it is very difficult to live among human beings, other human beings who are having some interactions with you, and they might cause you some troubles, and chances those troubles might turn your life upside down because some people in some turns of your life would do you some wrongs that will never be healed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It happens. And we've seen it a lot. We've read so much of books. Yeah. We've watched too much of movies. And if it's not just that, we have been into many occasions in our real life. So we know that it happens.
You know, yeah, it happens actually every day. In every day of life, even there are people that just hurt you or something. But I want to tell you a fact about human beings. Human beings are like, you know, just they forget good, bad things in the past. You know, you tend to forget any bad actually accidents in the past and just remembering the good things about the past, you know. And I have evidence. For example,
What if I don't forget?
No, I have evidence.
One of the hardest things to forget is the evil somebody's done to you.
No, because, for example, if you go, for example, talk to the older generation, they're like, okay, when I was younger, everything was so beautiful and we were just living so friendly. It's not like that they were living friendly or something. It's the fact that they forget the bad things about the past. You know, this is, I think,
now you're actually, Vita, there's a problem in here. You're talking about some trivial issues that happened. For example, there was a rainy day in which I didn't have any money. Then, okay, when time comes up and then I have a good situation in my life, I go further, I develop in my career or whatever, then I would forget that. But if, as a friend, I trust you so much, then I tell you a secret. And then after a while, you show me the tables turn and then you show me your true face. So I would never forget that.
You know,
and you can even forgive sometimes, but to forget that happened.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, you can even, you can go back to good relations with the person. You can love the person, but you will not, you won't forget that this happened.
Definitely.
Right?
Yeah.
It's too bitter. It leaves a scar in you, right?
Yeah.
So I've gone through different scenarios that if you ask me right now the details, I can tell you all the details
exactly.
about that event.
Yeah.
All the details, my own feelings, what was happening, you know, and it's like I've gone past it, right? If I meet that person, I'll be completely fine with them. Right? Mm-hmm. But I can't forget exactly what happened.
So what should we do to heal this scar?
Now you should tell us because you were the one who said, I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care.
How?
Really.
How is it?
Because it's
teach me how not to
care.
Me.
You know, it's the way I'm looking about at other people, you know. The value of that person is something that I have to accept from that person. You know, for example, I expect you to be my friend. Mm-hmm. Is this expectation, you know, according to what? You know, for example, you are a person who cannot be my friend.
So you mean I have a credit in your heart and mind?
Yeah, exactly. So according to this credit, I have to judge you, I have to be mad at you,
and I have to
trust forgive you even, you know? Yeah. For example, sometimes there is a friend, there is a family that you don't expect that person to do something. And in this situation, yes, it's harder to forgive, it's harder to forget. And
yeah,
also,
of course.
Sometimes it comes to revenge, you know?
And this
scar, because you cannot heal it, you want to actually make the same scar on that person. Mm-hmm. Because there is no way to heal your scar, your own scar. And this revenge actually did happen to me. I wanted to actually take revenge from that person.
Yeah.
But I was thinking like, okay, let's think about after this revenge. So what? What will you do?
You're not going to be eased up, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to appease you. Revenge is not going to alleviate
you. I thought deeper and I understood that that person was not the person who was just making the whole mistake. Mm-hmm. I was a part of it too.
Now, brother,
that's a good point. That, in order to get over something, especially when somebody wrongs, it's not a bad idea to look at your own role in that, right? Sometimes, so one of the ways to get by it is just not care, right? It's a good strategy. I won't disagree. Like, you couldn't care less.
But
you know, this person isn't important. When that person isn't important, it's not very difficult. But when they're important, let's say it's your own parents, your spouse, your siblings, or your best friend, then it's very difficult to forget. Then you have to look for another strategy because you can't be like, I don't care. Of course I do care. You know, they're very close to me. Then you can think about, for example, maybe I'm part of the fault, right?
Exactly.
And when you think about that, then you're not going to be angry at yourself. So this is going to appease your feeling of anger against that person will appease.
Now, I not only hate that person, I hate myself as well.
No, but that doesn't happen, right? You end up forgiving them, becoming more lenient to them because you're being lenient to yourself as well. And I think bigger than that is to think bigger and be like, you know what? I want to be the bigger person. I want to be the one to forgive, you know?
Now let's go for a short break, after which we'll pursue our discussion.
Thank you.
welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We're talking about forgiving other people who's done us wrong. We came to the conclusion that it's sometimes good not to care, but when it comes to important people in our life, it's actually very difficult. It's a drudgery not to care. And also, we came to the conclusion that if we think properly, we also have had a role in the thing that happens. So this way, maybe we're going to be appeased and not accusing that person only of the thing that has happened. Still, I think it's pretty difficult because then I would hate myself as well. Now, you, brother, said that I expect God to forgive me whenever I do any sin. Therefore, I use that as a strategy in order to apply it myself.
I think it's a good way of, you see, like we've mentioned many times, that our actions are a result of our thinking, right? Forgiving is an action, right? How can I make forgiving easier for myself? Mm-hmm. If I sort out at the level of thinking, then this action will come out better. If I'm at the level of thinking, I come to realize that Allah forgives me whenever I ask for forgiveness. And I disobey Allah probably every hour, probably I commit one sin, right? And I expect Allah to forgive me without anything in return, right? Just, oh Allah, please forgive me, and I expect that. Well, if this other person has wronged me, then I should also do the same.
You know what? There's a thing I would like to say in this issue, regarding this issue. Well, when I do something wrong to God, I'm so trivial of a thing compared to God.
Yeah, so this is what I want to say, that the easiest way to make forgiveness easy for us is that if we grow as a human being, and this is something I had learned when I was before I was getting married, and I was looking at tips for having a healthy marriage, and I remember this tip, and that was one of the best things that has helped me since then, and I've been married for a few years now, and that was that, look, if you fill your heart with the love of Allah, if you're full from inside, you don't have expectations from others, forgiving people becomes very easy now, because they hurt you. Well, it's okay, I forgive you. Because you're full now. Things don't penetrate your heart. When they hurt you, it's a very surface hurting now.
That needs too much of practice and growth.
Of course, and we want to grow as human beings. That's why we're sitting here and discussing these things, because we want to think about how can we grow as human beings, right? The world ain't going to change. We have to change.
At the end of the day, when we all die, people would not remember who we definitely were, but they would remember how they felt about us. So we should be very cautious and careful about every single action we take in front of other people, every single thing we say. And we must make sure that whatever we do in this world has got a reaction. So do not think that if you do something wrong to someone, don't go for asking forgiveness, it's going to be left just like this. No, one day you're going to pay for whatever you've done. So thank you, dear listeners. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The question that has haunted the Brits' minds these days is that whether Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, could handle the looming recession in Britain. This question is answered by experts in different media websites. Stay tuned for the details, please. Global Times wrote, after months of political struggle and economic hardship, Britons are now looking at Rishi Sunak, their third prime minister in 2 months, and the first British Asian prime minister, also one of the richest country ever had. Yet Chinese observers are cautious that he could be the savior of a crisis-laden UK. The recent frequent change of prime ministers in the UK has thrown the country into a once-in-a-generation political turmoil. Although the selection of Sunak offers a momentary relief, experts are warning that Sunak faces several uphill challenges, including saving the crumbling economy and navigating through political headwinds, which if he fails to do, might toss the country into yet another impasse. Sunak has used his first speech as prime minister to warn the UK is in the grips of an economic crisis, as he vowed to fix mistakes made by Liz Truss and win back voters' trust. Addressing the nation recently, Sunak warned there would be difficult decisions to come in an attempt to regain economic stability and avoid mass borrowing mounting up. He was asked by the king at Buckingham Palace to form a government before officially taking power. Sunak, a former chancellor, won the public support of almost 200 of his conservative MP colleagues to succeed Liz Truss, who resigned last Thursday after a chaotic 6 weeks in office. Speaking on Sunak's assuming office, Wang Wenbin, spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said recently at a press briefing that he hopes the UK can push the bilateral ties on the right track on the basis of mutual respect and win-win cooperation. Sunak had challenged Truss this summer in race of prime minister, but lost to her in a vote of the party's rank-and-file members. Chinese experts said this latest series of political drama surrounding the UK premiership has exposed the rigidity and decay of UK's political system, which can hardly produce capable politicians to make optimal decisions for the country. The Conservative Party, which is now in power, chooses someone who is eligible for the Downing Street, and before this person presents a decent plan of governance, he or she is stabbed in the back by opponents in the party and steps down. Zhao Junji, a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Institute of European Studies, told the Global Times, describing this pattern has made the UK politics more dramatic than late-night TV drama. He warned that one of the toughest tasks Sunak faces is how to survive until next election, originally scheduled for January 2025. Right after Sunak won the Conservative Party leadership race, there were calls for a general election by voices from other political parties. Labour lawmaker Angela Rayner complained that Sunak's accession was a coronation and that the Tories could not keep doling out prime ministers every month. After Truss stepped down, one petition calling for a general election had attracted more than 879,000 signatures. In the UK, general elections must be held at least every 5 years. However, the prospect of Britain seeing its third prime minister since the last poll in 2019 and the second to come into power without a public vote will put pressure on Truss's successor to ask the public for a new mandate, CNN reported. The possibility of earlier elections is very high. If Sunak fails to tackle the sky-high inflation in the UK in half a year of his governance, or meets strong pushback of his policies, or encounter major obstacles of forming a cabinet. Lee Guangji, a research fellow from the Shanghai Academy of Global Governance and Area Studies under the Shanghai International Studies, told the Global Times. Although observers granted Sunak, who possesses technocratic style of governing, they don't believe he is the savior of a crisis-wrecked UK. Except for different dissent, Sunak is no different from his Conservative Party predecessors. The election is in essence an election within the Conservative Party, thus the desirable candidates are just chosen by Conservative Party members who are mostly rich, said Zhao. Zhao noted that Sunak's Indian heritage and his wealth may put him under more strict scrutiny as prime minister, and in return will weigh on his decision-making process. Being a leader from a minority group, he may tend to be more conservative just to avoid wide criticism, and he will be very vulnerable if people see his policy as favoring the rich and big companies, said Zhao. The New York Times also reported that critics speculated that Sunak's Indian heritage might have hurt him in the race with some party members this summer. His wealth was viewed as the bigger issue. Also, Middle East Eye wrote, this takes writers to the big question mark surrounding the Sunak premiership. How will he handle the looming recession in Britain? Ever since John Maynard Keynes reinvented the laws of economics in 1930s, governments have increased spending to combat recessions. With a financial black hole to be filled, Sunak's masters in the financial markets will not allow him to boost output through fiscal methods. They will insist on cuts, forcing Britain into austerity. Unemployment will rise. Living standards will fall faster than at any time in the post-war period. Public services will be slashed, meaning poverty and even destitution. Britain has not faced a period like this since the oil crisis in 1970s, and possibly experts fear even the Great Depression of 1930s. So-called Truss Economics was an attempt to evade this predicament. Sunak will have to face it. As Chancellor, Sunak has proved that he has the financial skills to manage the national budget. Has this unelected prime minister got the political skills to explain spending cuts and job losses to the British people? On the evidence so far, the answer is no. Sunak started out as favorite to win last summer's Tory leadership campaign. He threw it away because he lacked charm, empathy, and authority. It was quite something to lose to a candidate as useless as Truss, but Sunak managed it. To his great credit, he did warn of the disastrous consequences of Truss's economic plans and had the good sense to steer clear of her short-lived government. But in other respects, he kowtowed to Tory members in his desperation to get the top job. Like her, he launched attacks on activist lawyers and stuck with the shaming and hopeless policy of shipping refugees to Rwanda. when Truss disastrously proposed in a letter to conservative friends of the Zionist regime to ponder a shift of the British embassy in the occupied territories to Al-Quds, hapless Sunak lacked the wit to steer clear of a daft policy certain to damage British interest. Not to be outdone, Sunak actually moved in lockstep with Truss, saying that he too would consider ripping up British foreign policy in the West Asia region in order to follow former US President Donald Trump's decision to shift the embassy. There is already evidence that, like Truss and Johnson before him, Sunak will end up being captured by the Tory right. According to a disturbing report in The Times, Sunak has assured Eurosceptics in private that he will maintain the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, stick with the Rwanda policy, introduce new legislation to prevent the European Convention on Human Rights blocking deportations, and to take a firm line on other ideologies in schools. If this report is accurate, Sunak will seek to win the necessary political capital to pursue brutal austerity policies by pandering to the far right and waging culture wars against the most vulnerable people in the world. To put it another way, he will try and make up for his lack of democratic legitimacy by resorting to ugly populism. If so, he will deserve to fail. Let's hope Britain's first Prime Minister of Asian heritage is better than that and possesses the courage to lead Britain out of the cesspit he inherits from Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. If so, there is a chance, with a lot of luck, that Sunak could become a good Prime Minister at this turmoil in Britain.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.